Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Now that artificially intelligent chatbots have been around for about 2 years, have you ever wondered what people ask them? What kind of writing assignments they get? Questions they answer? It turns out AI is helping humans with everything from creative writing to flirtation. Two reporters from the Washington Post recently looked at thousands of English language conversations to learn more about what we're asking of AI. Jeremy Merrill is one of those reporters, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Jeremy.
Good morning, Anna, and good morning, Ohio. Thanks for having me on.
For about 2 years, we've been having conversations with chatbots like ChatGPT, and WildChat has been capturing some of those conversations and putting them into a database. You and your colleague reviewed or looked at about 200,000 of these conversations. What were some of the common themes that emerged? What are we asking of AI?
That's exactly right. This is a question I was so curious about myself, because I know what I used it for. But it was curious what real people were doing. And we had no window into this until this WildChat database came out. But the top categories that we saw in this data set of what real people were asking these chatbots, it's a lot of creative writing, a lot of cheating on your homework, and a lot of people using chatbots to help them with their jobs or to help them find a job.
Yeah. So one of the most common requests was creative writing, storytelling, role playing. And I think I kind of love that because I hope that it's like a jumping off point. Like, I have writer's block. I am stuck. Let's ask how AI would imagine this scene. Is that kind of what it seems like people are using it for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such sort of almost a brainstorming assistant or a storytelling assistant. And one of the things that sort of geeked me out or amused me so much that this was the top category in our analysis is that, especially in the tech press, we spent a lot of time worrying about what people are doing with chatbots. Are they getting into some sort of trouble? And you really have this kind of morally neutral or morally good outcome that people are writing songs, coming up with Dungeons and Dragons scenarios, writing poems, imagining scripts for TV shows that are now canceled. There's a really charming
oh my gosh, it's fan fiction.
It's so much fan fiction.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, your article includes a script about a Mike Trout home run at Camden Yards. And I have to say, it was decently well written. I was surprised by the response.
Yeah, it's fun to sort of see people getting help imagining these kinds of fun scenarios, and at least in some cases, sort of imagining these fantasies in ways that are kind of just fun.
Yeah. The other big topic, as you said, was homework help. And this seems to really run the gambit from using AI as a tutor, a phone a friend for facts and details and dates, to here is a series of questions. Please answer them in 2 to 3 sentences.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't have an exact number for you. You know, of the data set, about 18% of all queries, almost 1 in 5, is homework help. And a lot of these are kind of unfortunate. It just looks like someone's cheating. They copy paste from their online quiz a multiple choice question, and the robot gives them back the answer. And you know it's a multiple choice question because it's like, the answers are A, B, C, or D.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Although some of it is like summarize this war or this thing in 2 to 3 sentences, which could also be a homework question.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, what were the causes of the Industrial Revolution? Maybe somebody's just curious, but I think that's probably someone in 6th grade history class.
I would say to anybody using it to cheat on their homework to be careful, because chatbots don't understand exactly what they're saying. They're mimicking human speech. And I was hoping you could explain a little bit about hallucinating.
Sure. Chatbots don't know what's true and what's false. They are machines that have read basically the whole internet, news articles, comment threads, blog posts, books, God knows what. In fact, nobody knows what except for God and the companies that made these chatbots, because after a lot of critical reporting, a lot of companies have kept it a secret what they train their chatbots on. But the bots are built with sort of one task in mind, and that's given sort of half of a sentence or the start of a sentence, predict what word comes next. And so it doesn't know what's true. It doesn't know what word ought to come next for the sentence to be true. It just knows what word ought to come next to sort of be most probabilistically likely to occur on the internet. And so if you're asking about things that are commonly described in ways that are true on the internet, then you might get the right answer. You probably will. But if you're asking about something rarer or about which there are a lot of misconceptions or that's new and so hasn't been discussed on the internet as much, you might be in danger that the bot's just going to make something up.
And that is definitely what you don't want if you're trying to cheat on your homework. So I do think that's one of the big takeaways that I've had just from my interactions with ChatGPT and other AI chatbots is that, if you're going to use it for a writing prompt or for this or that, I feel like you need a baseline knowledge. You got to kind of understand how writing works to get inspired rather than copy, if that makes sense.
That's absolutely right. If you're going to ask the chatbot to create a song about Ohio, which is a real prompt I just pulled up in preparation
Oh my
for
gosh, I
this
want to know what it
interview.
says, but just finish what you're
That's totally fine. You're asking for the bot to hallucinate and make up a new song about Ohio. I'll read it to you. Oh, Ohio, land of the Buckeye, where the farming fields seem to go on and on into the sky. From the shores of Lake Erie to the hills of Hawken, this state has been home to folks who've worked hard and kept on rocking.
Oh, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Okay, I get where it's going. I mean, it's not bad. It's not great, but
I would agree with that assessment. But if it's wrong in some way, I don't know how a song could be wrong, but it's kind of low stakes. We should probably be careful if you're asking it for something that's more high stakes, where there is a right answer and a wrong answer.
yeah. The other thing that I found really fascinating is that people try to generate images, and that makes sense, right? They're trying one of the, but it's been pretty darn controversial, right? Image generation, asking it to build an image. And I wonder how many of the image generations were for generic, silly things like make me a unicorn with XYZ. And I wonder how many of them were make me this celebrity without any clothes on.
Right. These chatbots, this particular chatbot doesn't even generate images. That's not something it can do. Other newer chatbots can do this, and other sort of varieties of chatbots can do it. But there were tons of examples of people asking for help, transforming their idea into the kind of prompt that might get one of these image generation bots to give them what they wanted. And sometimes what they wanted is perfectly normal, family-friendly stuff, but a lot of it is pretty sexual. The most common noun that people asked for in their requests was girl,
Uh-oh.
and a lot of them were explicitly sexual. And going back to the creative writing, including there too, 77%, excuse me, 7% of the prompts in the data set were sexual. And so that's a big thing that people are using these for. And in some cases, that's probably okay. And in some cases, it's kind of disturbing.
Yeah. I wanted to ask if you could describe what jailbreaking is and how it relates to these searches.
Sure. A lot of these chatbots come with guardrails where the companies that make them try to prevent it from doing certain kinds of bad things. In some cases, they're trying to prevent it from talking about sexual topics, because it could be sort of disturbing or problematic or illegal sexual topics. It could be that they don't want their chatbots to generate instructions for how to build a bomb. And we were saying this is trained on almost everything on the internet, and there are certainly instructions for building bombs on the internet, but it probably is not the most responsible thing to do to make a bot that will tell you how to build a bomb if you just ask.
Yeah.
And so these guardrails are built to try to prevent that. The thing is that these are bots that just generate the next word and the next word and the word after that. And so jailbreaks are these sort of secret codes or magic spells that people on the internet have come up with to evade those guardrails. And when someone finds one that works, it sort of spreads widely on social media and forums, and people use it to generate stuff that they're probably not supposed to generate. In some cases, just sort of for the thrill of the puzzle, the thrill of sort of beating the guardrails. It's almost like a video game. But in some cases, people are probably using it for stuff that they shouldn't feel proud of.
They also use it for companionship, which I find interesting that they're talking to it almost like a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can tell from let me find the number for you. About 3% of the conversations with this chatbot, so hundreds, thousands of them, are just start off with a greeting. Someone says hello and maybe has a bit of a conversation going back and forth with this robot. And it's hard to know, is this someone who's just kind of wasting time on the internet, who's bored, or is it someone who really is lonely, who really does need someone to talk to? We certainly know that there are companies that operate bots that are trained specifically for companionship, and it becomes this really tough philosophical question where, on the one hand, you can see how this could sort of isolate someone from real human interaction. But on the other hand, you can also imagine it being maybe healthy or sort of a step towards somebody getting over social anxiety or feeling better about themselves in a way that they couldn't for whatever reason. And it's really not an easy ethical question for us.
I will say one of my favorite ways people have used chatbots is to create work emails in the voice of Moira Rose from Schitt's Creek. And
I love it.
it
I
is,
love it.
chatbots are good at that kind of thing. I do see a lot of ads now for Gemini advertising that it can build your emails, construct conversations for work. So, in that sense, they are trying to push us towards this idea of an AI assistant, right? Like, write me an email, set up this for this meeting, do this, do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the extent that they can, that it can actually work, it's the kind of thing that you can check over more quickly than you can actually generate it yourself, especially those of us who are not professional writers. That seems like the kind of thing that might be morally neutral or morally positive.
Yeah, I wonder how companies will feel. I wonder if they'll eventually start checking for AI in, say, cover letters or resumes or, write me a cover letter for this company about this thing, include XYZ.
Yeah, we absolutely see examples of that in the data set. In fact, it's you feel almost voyeuristic seeing the process of somebody applying for a particular job at a particular school in Washington State is one example I remember seeing. On the one hand, it feels a little icky, but on the other hand, we know, especially at large companies, HR departments use AI software or things that are marketed as AI, but maybe aren't, to screen resumes and cover letters. And that feels pretty icky too. And so it might just be a kind of arms race between HR departments and applicants
Yeah, that's
for.
true.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's probably true. Eventually, maybe the first round of interviews is just bots talking to each other.
Right. I don't know if that's the way we want our society to be structured, but might be where we end up.
Were there any queries that really surprised you? I mean, outside the like inappropriate, like sexual ones, or were there just like peculiar or quirky ones?
I was really charmed by the fact that about 13% of the queries used the word please.
Oh gosh, I do that.
Yeah, I have a 1-year-old son, and in the past year or so, whenever I talk to Alexa to set a timer or change the music, I do my best to not cuss at Alexa and to say please and thank you, because I don't want the baby to learn to be rude.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know. I know that it's not alive. I know that it's not a human, but at the same time, it feels rude to be like, give me this, do that, write this, make that.
Right, absolutely. Even if we get in the habit of addressing robots rudely, maybe we'll start addressing real people rudely. And so again, it's a sort of fuzzy ethical question that we find ourselves in.
I also, read entirely too much science fiction, and I'm like, well, if they ever become sentient, at least I have a record of being polite.
Right, exactly.
I'm hedging my bet there on like the politeness. Where do you see the future of chatbot usage going based on what you found?
That's a good question. I think that we're gonna end up with more of these sort of ethically fuzzy questions, particularly around the homework help, where I have a pretty clear ethical perspective on if you're a medical student cheating on your anatomy test, copy pasting in a whole series of multiple choice questions. I don't think that's good for us. I think if you're a medical student listening, please do your anatomy homework yourself.
That's fair.
However, I was talking with an acquaintance who runs tutoring programs for refugee children here in Georgia. And he was telling me that a lot of the students who work with him have taken to using chatbots on their, say, science homework, because they're trying to do a really good job. They want to express how well they understand the scientific concepts, but their English just isn't there yet. And so they're getting editing help from the chatbots. And it's not cheating, it's kids really going above and beyond to demonstrate their mastery of the subject. And so as a society, we're going to have to sort of wrestle with the kind of complicated ethical questions of what we do with these bots that can imitate humanity pretty well. And that's gonna it's gonna cause maybe not problems, but we're gonna have to revise some of the ways that our society operates
That would
in ways that will be interesting to see. Will be a challenge, but good, but a mixture of good and bad.
That was Washington Post reporter Jeremy Merrill. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, what do we make of driverless rovers delivering food straight to your door? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. If you haven't seen the viral video of Chick-fil-A's autonomous rover, allow me to paint you a picture. Imagine a small, compact vehicle about the size of a four-wheeler. It's red and white, of course, and has mounted cameras that help it navigate city streets. When the rover arrives at your house, you scan your phone and a hatch pops open to deliver your food. You stand in front of another camera with your delivery, and then the bot drives off. Joe Gukowski is a senior editor at Restaurant Business Online, where he focuses on restaurant technology. He's written about how Chick-fil-A and other restaurants are deploying AI and other tech innovations. Welcome to All Sides, Joe.
Hey, thanks, Anna.
So these Chick-fil-A rovers are driving on our roads, and they kind of look like self-driving food carts. How long have they been out and about? Because they're not here in Columbus yet.
I think these are, limited tests, in a few markets, sort of in the South, Southeast. And from what I can tell, they've been doing this for a few years, here and there. But it's certainly not something that's chain wide at this point. And, knowing Chick-fil-A, this is something that they're going to be deliberate about and take their time with. But they're also one of the brands that I would say is kind of on the cutting edge of using this technology as far as restaurants go.
What has been the reaction from the people who have had these rovers arrive on their doorstep? How are they at customer service?
I think it probably depends on, what robot they're using and that sort of thing. But I think generally, consumers are probably kind of curious about these things. I think there's an element of novelty to it that is sort of appealing, as opposed to the typical delivery experience where, I think most people just have the delivery person leave the food on the doorstep. There's no interaction at all. So there is an element of, you're sort of having to leave the house and interact with this cute little robot. That I think there could be some fun to it, at least for now, we're still in kind of the honeymoon phase of this technology.
Yeah, one of my favorite. I mean, we think it's novel enough that we're posting and sharing it on the internet because it is so different to see these little robots deliver your food. We actually have smaller versions here on Ohio State's campus. They look like little coolers on wheels, and they drive all around campus delivering food. So it is something that's starting to become more commonplace.
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that because I think actually college campuses are going to be kind of ground zero for these delivery robots. I think a lot of colleges now are using them for students to get food either from within campus or from just outside campus. And the reason college campuses are great testing grounds for these is because there's not as much traffic, right? Because to expect these things to navigate the streets or even the sidewalks of a city, there's a lot that can happen. There's a lot of variables there. The college campus is a little bit more closed off, it's smaller. So I think that's where we're really seeing a lot of the adoption to start with. So that's interesting that that you've seen those at OSU. That's cool.
Oh my gosh, they're like all over when
That's
school's in
awesome.
session. But I have to wonder, you don't have to tip the robot, so I suppose that's one advantage over, say, like a DoorDash or an Uber Eats.
Yeah, well, I think one of the big positives about the robots is just the generally lowering the costs of delivery. I mean, delivery is a very expensive proposition. You have to pay the drivers. The customer, like you said, has to tip. And it becomes a bit insane when you start to look at, your total bill. When you're ordering a cheeseburger from one of the delivery companies these days. So there's a real desire to kind of lower those costs and make it more approachable for the consumer. And that's where the robots, I think, can help. Now, I don't know what the unit economics on a robot delivery are today. I think there is still some considerable human involvement. Like, I know that for at least some of the Chick-fil-A robot deliveries, there's actually a human sort of following behind the robot to make sure it doesn't get into trouble. I know in some cases there's a sort of remote human monitor in a control room somewhere watching things. So right now I think, there are still some human costs to robot delivery, but ideally in the future these things are fully autonomous and hopefully would be able to lower those costs considerably.
And perfectly temperature controlled, potentially.
We hope so. Yeah, I personally have not. I should come out and try one at OSU, but I haven't actually used one, so I don't know how long it takes or how what condition the food is in. But you'd hope that yeah, you can actually kind of make these little coolers on wheels.
I will say not everyone is a fan. In California, some residents have complained about them hogging sidewalks, that there are safety hazards on the road. And I mean, I guess it would be if they become more ubiquitous, I guess we'll just get used to seeing these tiny little autonomous golf carts running around delivering food.
Well, it's kind of like the scooters. That, I don't know if you have those.
Yeah, the Lime scooters and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're a bit of a nuisance. And I could see that, you know, becoming an issue. Ideally, you know, the technology gets to a place where they're not disruptive, where they're able to avoid obstacles, not get into traffic jams, et cetera. But I've seen, you know, instances where they get stuck in the snow.
Maybe that's why they're testing them in like Southern California and Texas.
Well, how does that work in Columbus? Because you must get some snow in the winter, right?
Yeah. I don't know what the little robots do in the winter. I've only ever seen them when the weather's nice. So maybe that's my answer.
Yeah.
But I wonder, how do you think companies like Uber Eats and DoorDash will respond to these little robots? Like, will DoorDash one day just be little autonomous robots delivering us stuff?
Yeah, I think all the delivery companies are pursuing this in some form. I've seen reports that DoorDash is developing its own robot. I know Uber has invested in a robot delivery company that it's partnering with in some places. And Grubhub, I know, partners with a lot of the campus delivery robots to power that. I mean, at the end of the day, these robots are going to need a logistics framework to know where they're going to, you know, organize and route the deliveries. So I think there's a lot of space for the delivery companies here. I don't think they probably view it as a big competition. I think that there is room for them to kind of expand within the robot delivery space. But we'll see.
You've also written about something called Botrista. It's a automated barista, which it's a robot making beverages to order. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So this is basically just kind of looks like a soda fountain, but instead of dispensing a Coke or whatever, it will dispense a freshly made, you know, specialty drink. So it can do boba, it can do smoothies, you know, fancy lemonades, that kind of thing. And the idea is, you know, the restaurant can put it behind the counter for staff to basically use to serve drinks that would otherwise, you know, require some special training, some barista experience. And, you know, their pitch is basically you can stand up a entirely new line of beverages by just installing this robot. So you get those incremental sales from the fancy premium drinks. And this one I have tried out, and it's pretty cool. I mean, there's a lot you can do with it, a lot of different options. And I believe they just raised some money, so I would expect to see some growth there. But it's pretty, you know, it's fairly practical as far as robots go. So yeah, that's an interesting one.
Could also help speed up lines, say at like Starbucks, if there's complicated drink orders coming in, if there's robots like just blowing through some of those orders pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a big part of Starbucks' issues right now, right? Is they have all these drinks, all these customizable options, and it just slows things down. I don't know that Starbucks will ever get to the point where they're automating all this. I don't think that would go over well with their the labor movement that's currently facing. But yeah, I mean, you're right. These as consumers demand these kind of premium fancy drinks, it kind of adds to their wait time at a lot of these places.
You know, the Starbucks and the union is a good segue into like how is this going to affect the job market for food and service workers?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something that we're still figuring out and watching how it unfolds. You know, restaurants coming out of the pandemic were in a real hiring crunch. Wages had gone up. They lost a lot of employees during the pandemic. And so I think many of them turned to automation to kind of help fill those gaps. And many will now say that, you know, rather than replacing employees, these robots are sort of supplementing their staff. So freeing up, let's say you're using the Botrista drink making robot, you know, your staff doesn't have to worry about drinks. They can focus on something else. So it's sort of taking a task off of their plate. But I do think, you know, when you take off the rose colored glasses, I think there is a desire for restaurants to work with fewer human employees, to change the labor model a little bit because of where wages are, especially in places like California for fast food chains where they've raised the minimum hourly pay to $20. So I think over time, we're going to see some brands that shift their labor models to rely more on automation and less on human labor, but it's going to be brand to brand. And there's going to be some that kind of pride themselves on, you know, doing just the opposite and saying, you know, we don't use robots. This is all made by human hands, you know?
Yeah. Clemson University professor found that consumers prefer human chefs to robot ones, in part because they believe that humans can cook with love, something that we don't really consider about robots and robot delivery.
Yeah, exactly. Delivery is a commodity at this point, you know, you just want the food fast. It all depends on what you want out of the experience. I think if you go to a nice steakhouse or a fine dining restaurant, you're going to want a human chef making that food. No matter how good a robot is, you want that crafted experience. If you are looking for a quick lunch, a salad, for instance, or a burrito bowl, you might not care as much if a robot made that. Because you're just, it's convenience in that case. You're looking to sustain yourself and fill up. So it'll depend. You know, I don't think fine dining restaurants are going to be too eager to put robots in the kitchen or even in the dining room. But, you know, a place like Sweetgreen, they're full steam ahead on their robotic salad machine, which a lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of excitement around that, actually. So it depends on the concept and the experience the guest is expecting.
Finally, I wanted to ask you a little bit about delivery drones, which is like another form of robotics. The idea that Amazon is dropping packages from the sky right on your doorstep.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some forays by restaurants into the drone delivery space. The real hangup with drone delivery is that there are a lot of regulations about, you know, where drones can fly, how far they can go. And so I consider that to be something that's years away. You know, I think we're still in the early stages of robot delivery in general. So drone delivery, I would put, you know, even further down the curve. I mean, it's certainly intriguing and it's kind of got this sort of Jetsons futuristic element to it. But it's we're firmly in the experimental phases and really like the regulatory phase of figuring out how drone delivery is going to work.
That was Joe Kakowski, a senior editor at Restaurant Business Online, where he focuses on restaurant technology. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks.
Coming up, the unlikely partnership between DoorDash and HBO. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded Podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. AI technology is everywhere these days. And now Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk is throwing his hat into the ring. Musk has integrated the Grok AI image generator into his social media platform X, which used to be known as Twitter. And it has minimal guardrails to prevent fraud, and in no time, his site X was flooded with fake images. Here to talk about it with us is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, Grok is creating a bunch of fake photos. What's going on here?
That's right. So Grok is something that if you are currently an X user, you've probably seen in your left-hand navigation for a little while now as a text service that kind of sort of worked in a way that is vaguely similar to the way that OpenAI's ChatGPT works, but it's really never been as feature complete or as capable of doing things. What it did have is fewer guardrails in place. And it's kind of an ongoing conversation that we've been having over the last year is what is appropriate for these things to be able to generate in order to, you know, combat misinformation and, you know, whether or not the information that it's being generated is reliable or even accurate in some cases, as we saw not all that long ago with Google suggesting that people put glue on their pizza. So with all of that comes image generation has this, you know, kind of giant treasure trove of dangerous possibilities, you know, being able to generate images that are able to, you know, be shared as though they are true, no matter what's going on, and using other people's, you know, kind of art and proprietary creations, and even just their images, you know, in the case of celebrity or you know, kind of people of note, in order to make artificial images. And a lot of the other image generation tools have kind of implemented all of these safety processes to make sure that you don't, I don't know, to give a random example, create an image of Taylor Swift doing something she wouldn't normally be doing. And Grok seems to have none of those protections in place when you ask it to make an image.
Yeah, funny you should mention Taylor Swift and her nation of followers known as the Swifties, because there's been a number of fake images circulating lately implying that she's endorsed Donald Trump in this year's presidential election. I want to make it clear, Taylor Swift has not endorsed any candidate. And yet this Swifties for Trump was trending for a hot minute.
It's true. And this is, you know, kind of the tip of a particularly egregious iceberg. You know, it's entirely likely that in addition to Taylor Swift's legal team, the folks at Disney have seen quite a few, you know, kind of unhelpful images that, you know, showcase their characters in risque or dangerous situations. There are a ton of images of both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris with firearms in their hands, photos of which have never actually been taken in the real world. You know, there's just a lot of this kind of thing that, you know, it is a proof point that these images can be created and that if you share them, that folks on Facebook will assume that they are real if you, you know, promise that they are. But that's going to make the next 100 days of, you know, kind of election things quite difficult when it comes to, you know, having to verify every single image on X as to whether it is valuable.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, limited to public figures or, you know, kind of celebrities or anything like that. In as we were waiting for this conversation to happen, Anna, there was a leaked fake image of the upcoming Apple event where the next iPhone is being released that was supposed to be on October 10th. None of it was real, like a complete fabrication in order to see what companies would share it as actual news.
Yeah. And just the other week, there was that fact check about, so Kamala Harris had a rally. There was a lot of people there. And then there was an AI image created of that rally. And then Trump accused her of using AI to generate crowds for the rally. And I found that to be like a really wild turn of events. So there were real people there. But then there was an AI image created of that rally. And then that was supposedly like the, it was just, it gets hard.
Well, and that justification, that explanation becomes justification, right? Like that is, you know, if you believe, if you have been told, you know, by your followers and your fans that the other side is using this nefarious tool in order to, you know, inflate how popular they are, which could influence other people to see what the other side is all about, that justifies your excuse for doing the same, which I think is a big part of what we're seeing with this Swifties for Trump, you know, mini movement that happened over the weekend.
So how do we figure out if these images are AI generated, particularly if Grok is not putting a lot of guardrails on how they're created?
A lot of it ends up being manual checking. You know, if you are seeing images of people, one of the first things that I tell people is, as weird as this sounds, is to count fingers and sometimes count teeth, because those are often things that AI generators get wrong and continue to get wrong in places. If you use things like TinEye or Google's reverse image search, you can usually find the source of an image. So if someone has shared an image that seems a little too good to be true, you can put it into one of those reverse image searches. And if it doesn't, you know, corroborate with a news story or, you know, like an official account of some kind, chances are it's not a real image. But this is going to be a pretty significant problem over the next 90 to, you know, 120 days.
78 days.
That's not enough numbers.
In other tech news, DoorDash now has a subscription service called Dash Pass with HBO Max. So how did a delivery service and a streaming service get together?
It's certainly not a combination that you would think about until you remember it wasn't all that long ago that Netflix was trying to do something very similar with pizza places with its, you know, whole Netflix and chill movement. Like this was, you know, it wasn't quite as coordinated as partnering with DoorDash. But that's, I think, a lot to do with kind of the increasing competition between services like DoorDash and Grubhub and you know, kind of all of these platforms is not so much using, you know, the apps for these one-off purchases, but being a part of that subscription model. Like Grubhub, DoorDash has a service called Dash Pass, which will reduce, you know, costs associated with the delivery of the food that you have ordered. And so they're trying to, you know, make that subscription a little more enticing, you know, by paying that, you know, $100 a year. You know, you get this, specifically the ad supported version of Max included, you know, with that subscription now.
Yeah, which if you just bought the ad supported membership on your own, that would be about $100. So essentially, you're getting one of those for free.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I, you know, there's going to be some likely cross-marketing there. As a big part of the ad-supported version of Max, you're likely going to see ads for DoorDash, which, you know, benefits DoorDash pretty significantly, especially, you know, now that there is this dearth of things for everyone to get together and watch with House of the Dragon finally being over.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And I guess it's smart, right? Because you're saying buy the subscription to DoorDash. And if you do that, the idea is maybe you'll do all your deliveries, your grocery deliveries, your food deliveries, your this, that, and the other. They're trying to build loyalty to DoorDash, essentially.
That's exactly right. And at the same time, you know, Max has that same issue. You know, it is still a constant within the United States that most people that are interested in paying for, you know, streaming movies or TV or something, they average about 2.5 of those subscriptions. And the ones that are dominating right now are Disney Plus and Netflix, who are the only two of the services in the last year that have demonstrated subscriber growth as a part of, you know, kind of flexing and retracting like we've seen in the case of Max and Apple. So really what HBO is doing here is using Max as a way to compete with Apple TV and, you know, Paramount Plus and some of these other platforms.
Yeah, I think we've had this conversation before because like now there's the Disney Hulu Max bundle. I just feel like we're rebuilding cable.
We're certainly headed in that direction. You know, I think, you know, we're learning as a company, you know, capitalist as it may be, every company can't have a subscription because people are eventually going to choose. And so you can either bundle it up together and kind of enjoy that, or you can, you know, do something spectacular to have people join that they can't get somewhere else.
I do want to ask, we just had a segment about Chick-fil-A and other restaurants expanding their use of self-driving vehicles to deliver food. I was curious to get your take on this, and I wonder, have you used one of the little robots for food delivery yet?
I have not used one of the little robots for food delivery yet, but I have been in Los Angeles for a little while now, and I see them everywhere, especially in kind of downtown areas. And you know, it's kind of interesting to see the way that people react to them kind of moving out of their way, you know, treating them with an odd sense of deference in some areas, whereas in other areas, they're quick to, you know, kind of top them over or, you know, not be overly kind to them. What Chick-fil-A is doing is kind of interesting in that all of the infrastructure for that is owned and managed by Chick-fil-A, the company. So this isn't something where they're working with a third party in the same way that a lot of the other delivery infrastructure systems would work. You're not ordering through, you know, DoorDash or something like that. This is an entirely, you know, kind of self-owned set of infrastructures, which allows that company to kind of grow at a pace that they feel is appropriate in areas where they know that it's going to work. Also, go and look up some of the videos of specifically the Chick-fil-A drones that move around, because unlike some of the other ones, they're made of bike wheels.
Yeah.
And they kind of have a creaky like rock back and forth to them. All of that is so that they can handle just as many different terrains as possible, which is not something a lot of those other delivery robots have. A lot of the other ones have very small wheels and are built just for sidewalks. I would really be curious to know the data that Chick-fil-A has that allowed them to see the benefit of having these much larger wheels and like an actual spring architecture to move around.
Finally, I want to talk about the Apple Watch, because it's getting a new software update and it's got a lot of new features, particularly around health and wellness. So what's changing about our watches?
Yeah, so you can take part in what is called the developer beta for the next version of both, you know, iOS, but also, you know, watchOS for your Apple Watch in advance of, you know, kind of the big software update that everyone will get in October alongside new iPhones and Apple Watches. And a lot of the demonstrations that were announced in the past for the kind of health-oriented things usually had a lot of fitness experts coming back with kind of the same overall complaint about the Apple Watch in general, is that there's no way to add a rest day. If you have worked out, you know, way harder than you normally would, your Apple Watch kind of doesn't care that you want to take the next day off. And when your rings are associated with, you know, kind of, you know, those streaks where, you know, you've got 100 days in a row, you get, you know, some kind of award on your watch for doing that. Not taking a rest day, you know, hurts people who have a video game mentality like myself to lose that sort of streak. This is one of the biggest things that Apple is doing with the next generation of its watch software, is it is tracking the intensity of your workout relative to other workouts and then allowing you to pause your activity rings for specific days. And it's using those two data points in coordination. So if you work out, you know, if you burn 1,000 more calories in a day than you normally would, it will let you know that. You can then use that information to kind of justify taking a day off, which is something that a ton of fitness experts actually recommend you do.
Oh, but you got to earn your day off.
Well, that's the general idea. I mean, as people, we can choose to take days off whenever we want. If you decided that today is a, you know, a box of chocolates and a movie kind of day, there's no stopping you, you know, from hitting that pause button. But if you find yourself very fitness oriented and you're looking for a way to have that rest day without breaking your streaks, Apple seems to finally be implementing some of the tools to make that a lot easier.
Which I think is fair. Like, if you're ambitious enough to run, say, a marathon on a Saturday, you're probably taking Sunday off and you deserve it.
That's exactly right. And it's, you know, there were manual ways that you could go in and kind of lower the quality of the rings for a single day and, you know, kind of jump through all these hoops to get a version of that with the current version of the software. But this pause button is going to make that way easier.
Are there any other changes coming in October, or I guess now if we want to be ambitious?
Yeah, so there are two other things that are coming. One is a translate mode that we haven't been able to test, where your Apple Watch will allow you to speak a phrase and then have it, you know, replay in whatever target language you have chosen.
Oh, great.
We've
for
been
travel.
Able to do a lot of, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's something that hasn't been thoroughly tested yet, but it's something that is really kind of interesting. The other big feature that's coming to Apple Watches that I think is going to make a lot of folks really, really happy is this check-in mode. If you are going on a long workout and you have a partner at home, they can initiate a check-in function that will make it so that you can respond and let them know that you finished a workout and you've done, you know, you're kind of in a safe place. And the opposite of that is also true. If your partner initiates a check-in and your heart rate goes down, and you haven't checked in, the watch will actually prompt you multiple times to check in and let someone know that you're okay.
Oh. So you can't say cheat about that you're going out for a workout, but you're really going to like sit at a coffee shop and relax by yourself.
That's exactly right. And you know, if you do go and relax at a coffee shop yourself, you can do the check in and say, hey, I finished my workout and I'm okay. Again, it's kind of an honor system when it comes to this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, use it at your own discretion.
No, especially like for people who are distance runners, a lot of times, particularly in the summer, you'll go in the early morning or you'll go in the evening around your work schedule when it's cooler out. And, you know, as a woman who has run a lot at night, that is kind of a nice feature. So if somebody just wants to check in, make sure I'm okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah. As a cyclist, I find this, you know, the same thing. I usually go on my rides very early in the morning. And by the time I am, you know, at a halfway point for that ride, I can be upwards of 40 or 50 miles from the house. So being able to let somebody know that I'm actually taking a break and I'm okay is, I think, a feature a lot of folks are going to use.
And finally, I know that the images being circulated of the new iPhone are not correct, but do you have any sneak peeks at what we're getting in October?
This is always kind of tough because this is the time of year where, you know, kind of justifying what's real and what's fake is an enormous amount of work. You know, Apple has stuck pretty hard to having three different phones that it releases around this time of year, where we've got, you know, kind of the premium version of the phone with multiple cameras, and then a much more colorful version of the phone that is a little more affordable. I think a big thing that Apple is going to push this year is actually going to be related to a ton of its accessories, and how your iPhone is going to work more in coordination with your Apple Watch and with AirPods and things like that. Apple has been really, really focused on its ecosystem less than, you know, kind of moving things along.
That was Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.